Alfred Kazin, obviously you are a book reader. Do you also collect books, and do you have room in your apartment for the books that you have?
I have spent my life, like Sinbad the Sailor, moving thousands of books around. I get books all the time, of course, but I don't review as many books now as I used to. Then I have disposed of many libraries. I have a library in my office at the university. I do a lot of my work there. I teach at the Graduate Center. I have this library which occupies a whole wall, two walls of our living room. It's very hard on Judith, though. But in your building, 788, there's a colleague of mine. Do you know Mr. William Elton? Ever seen him?
No, the name is not.
Bill Elton is a colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. He's a Shakespeare man at the Graduate Center where I teach. And he's not married. And apparently, I just saw it briefly once from the outside door. He has so many books that that the floor is seriously threatened.
Is that right?
I think he's on the 10th floor. What floor are you
on? I'm on the 14th.
Oh, good. You probably he may come crashing down. He's being moved to the Institute for Advanced Study, and his office is occupied by enormous crates. He's surrounded by crates of books because they haven't come to move the books yet.
Well,
it's a disease, you know.
Yeah, I do. I have a tremendous book storage problem, and many of my books now, I would say almost half, are now in boxes in the closet. And, but I like the idea of being surrounded by books, and I usually save only books of literary value, and usually only in first edition, because I just don't have room. And I have many inscribed books, and but it just gives
what
me...
What kind of books you have?
Inscribed.
Yeah.
And it gives me much pleasure to be surrounded, to sit at my desk. And I, of course, my desk is essentially in the center of the living room.
Yes.
But and I have the books on a wall there, and also in the hallway going back to the bedrooms, I have books. But what I do now, as books come in, I get a lot of review copies, but most of them are not very important books. And I put them in a laundry cart, and every month or so we take them over to the public library.
Oh, great.
Because of the space problem. I want to ask you some questions about the American procession.
Are we on now?
Yes, we are. And some things about yourself. Your early days, you grew up in Brooklyn.
Yes.
What prefigured your literary history during these days as you were growing up in Brooklyn? Great interest of yours in literature and your ultimate role to become a literary critic.
Well, not a literary critic. I've always regarded myself as one of those critics who tries to be a writer, and I've written many things which are not criticism. I've written a three-volume experimental autobiography. I don't know what the answer is. Both my parents are working people. Mother was a dressmaker, my father a house painter. They were both Russian Jewish immigrants. They were quite illiterate. My mother entirely so. My father thought he was not illiterate, and he could read, you know, newspapers. But on the other hand, there's nothing unusual about that. This is not an explanation. I don't pretend to know. My sister Pearl Bell, who's married to Daniel Bell at Harvard, is also a writer, has written many things. But then there's people like Saul Bellow and Bernard Malamud and people my generation who had the same background also found themselves becoming writers in the same way. There's nothing unusual about this. All I know is that growing up in the Depression and all that, it never astonished me that my parents did not refuse me anything about books. My sister and I were both allowed to finish college in the 30s, though my father was unemployed for 5 years. My mother kept us going as a home dressmaker. I described all this in a book called A Walker in the City and a book called Starting Out in the 30s. And I remember very fondly that my mother once brought back a set of Ruskin, which she bought for $2 on a pushcart in the East Side. She was shopping there, and she didn't know Ruskin from a cloud. But she figured all those books for $2 couldn't be a bad investment, so she carried them all the way from the Lower East Side to where we lived, and we lived at the end of the subway line in Brooklyn, two stops away from New Lots Avenue, and that was a long haul. All I know is that we were encouraged, but not understood. I don't know how these things, but there are people around me who became professional murderers, there are people around me who became extraordinary scientists. There were two or three Nobel Prize scientists from my neighborhood, as well as the famous murder gang called Murder Incorporated. It was no different, probably, in many ways, from the kind of ghetto which prevailed in many European cities. I suppose if there's one thing there, it has to do with the fact that though I was born here and all that, very much alive to my parents' European past and to the enormous sufferings that had brought the Russian Jews over here. But then I was fascinated by the story. My mother came over alone as a seamstress because she felt she wouldn't get a husband in Russia. She was the only homely girl in a family of many sisters. So all her sisters were killed by Hitler, and she alone survived. Mm. That story, the time I first heard about it, made me recognize that I had some extraordinary historical material to, not just to draw upon, but to live. And also, the other thing, of course, was that the working class movement, that kind of democratic socialism, represented first by Eugene Debs and then by Norman Thomas, was my father's daily oxygen. And I grew up in that atmosphere. With the result that, among other things, I think it can be said that that from a very early age, and nothing has changed that up to the age of 69, I was always very suspicious of power in America, wealth, things like that. And one of my greatest memories of a depression is my mother leading a pack of women to put the furniture back of a family been evicted in the 30s, a very common sight in Dockers, Brooklyn in 1936-37.
They dumped the furniture out on the sidewalk. Yeah.
They don't?
They dumped the furniture out on the sidewalk.
Oh, yes, and they used to put a tin can on. People would drop coins into the floor. My mother couldn't stand this, and she went. And although she was not an abstract thinker, she was a very delicate dressmaker, worked at home, she had a kind of thorough suspicion of power, so to speak, and of wealth, which I don't think I've ever lost myself.
What was college like?
I went to City College, of course. Where else would one go from that kind of family? It was awful. It was awful because it was a male college, because I went to City College was and is at 137th Street, and took me an hour and a quarter on the subway to get there. I was not a particularly good student. I was too much interested in things I cared about. It was a period of a tremendous radical turbulence, of course. The Stalinists and the Trotskyites, the Lufsenites, and all sorts of left-wing groups were always battling each other. I managed to do my work, and then but the big thing that happened to me as a person, as a writer, was that I began to review very early, before I was out of college. And I began at 20. I must be the only person still writing for the Times Book Review who's been writing for them for almost half a century.
Mm.
And then
How did you do that? How did you wrangle those plums?
It wasn't difficult. It's not never difficult to get a review. It was difficult getting a second review. The Times Book Review in those places always needed people. And also they didn't pay anything to speak up in those days. No, but I apparently had a knack for it, shall we say. And then the great thing that saved my life and made everything possible was there was a famous critic and Columbia professor at that time called Carl Van Doren, the famous Van Doren family. The Van Dorens were really quite a family. Irita Van Doren, his ex-wife, ran the Herald Tribune Book Review section. Mark Van Doren, his younger brother, was one of the great, great teachers at Columbia. And I was there for a year doing graduate work. And Carl Van Doren liked my reviews and said, you ought to write a book. And I was always looking for a job and trying to make it. I did radio scripts. I tutored. I used to dramatize Dickens and Poe for the radio, some terrible little radio station in Brooklyn, which was so ignorable that the announcer would say at 12 o'clock or something, this is W something, and is anybody listening? That's what it is. Anyway, Mr. Van Doren said, you ought to write a book. And I said, I need a job. And he said, write this book, you'll get a job. And then through a variety of reasons, I was able, to write my first book on native grounds. which later on astonished everybody because I was 27 when it came out. But I'd been reading intensely all my life. And at that time, New York Public Library was open every day of the year, including, except Christmas, I think, from 10 in the morning to 10 at night. And I read myself sick, read enormous literature. And I had people who were interested in my work. I got a Guggenheim Fellowship, this sort of thing. Also, you know, in the 30s, prices were lower than they had been in the 19th century. My then wife, who was a bacteriologist, and I lived very comfortably on a rent of $50 a month in Brooklyn Heights. And we used to eat in the automat. And because she was working on her doctorate all the time at Bellevue. And so finally the book came out. And then, of course, by that time, the book came out in 42. The war was on. I'd had an accident and was turned down, but I was determined to get overseas. So because of my book, I was able to become a reporter in England. I'd been teaching on and off. But you want all this? Anyway.
It's fascinating.
And then after the war, it turned out that writers like myself, Sorbello, Malam, a great many people who did not have PhDs, never wanted a PhD, were asked to teach because their books and articles were well known. The big change in American teaching and literature was that modern literature came into the academy, became very fashionable. In fact, it became much too fashionable. In 1937-38, when I was taking an MA at Columbia, a friend of mine, Robert Elias, who later on taught for many years at Cornell, was refused permission to do his PhD thesis on Theodore Dreiser. Though in 1937-38, Dreiser had not written a good book since An American Tragedy. That was 1925. And he was told that you couldn't write about a living author, though there was some doubt as to whether Theodore Dreiser was really living at that moment. He died in 1945. So he told him he would live without them. He went to University of Pennsylvania. And then he wrote to Dreiser, asked for papers and such. Dreiser, it turned out, had saved every playbill from the 1890s, every shoestring, every love letter, and poured all this out on the library of the University of Pennsylvania, which for many years now have been publishing his diaries, this letters, all that stuff. But all that has changed, of course. Nowadays, you know, students of mine who take a PhD write on, I don't know, Ann Beatty or certainly John Updike, Robert Lowe, you know. Things become almost a joke. I tend, as a matter of fact, to try to discourage it because there's no way of learning anything if you concentrate on contemporary literature. And then I began to teach and this and that and so on.
You developed a relationship with a number of prominent writers during the 40s, people like Dos Passos, I understand?
No. That was you saw that in that.
Yeah.
That was not true. I knew Dos Passos, but Mitkang got that wrong. Don't put this into the script. I never told them. And what happened was that I knew Dos Passos in Provincetown. I used to go up to the Cape every summer. But we were not friends. And the idea that was reported there that we remained friends as far as right-wing views was just preposterous. I interviewed him. The last time I saw him on Channel 13, he read parts of USA, and I interviewed him. I knew Bellow and Malam. Malam was a classmate of mine, and Bellow I met in 1942 when I was book editor of the New Republic.
James D. Farrell?
I knew Farrell very well, extremely well.
Elliot?
I met Elliot twice. I met him in England during the war when I had to interview him as part of my work. I was writing about an experimental program in the British Army, and he had taught in a working-class district, after he had come to England. And then, as I relate, the book is very funny. I met him April 45, right after President Roosevelt died, and after I had consulted him about the work I was doing. He suddenly, to my surprise, turned to me and said, what's this Truman like? And I thought, I'd been overseas, and, you know, like most people, I didn't even know much about Truman. And then I suddenly began to laugh. I said, you ought to know, you both come from the same state, after all. Elliot was born in St. Louis. So he laughed, and he recited a little ditty for me, which something about someone or so-and-so would make a good mayor of St. Louis in a bad year. Anyway, some years later, my then publisher had a party for him, and I was there, and he was quite tight, and Alan Tate, the poet, took him around to meet people. And when he introduced to me, he said, "Well, now we know what Truman is like." I thought it was very charming.
You mentioned a moment ago that you thought it was a joke for students to write their dissertations on some of the modern writers. You mentioned Ann Beattie.
Contemporary writers.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, there is very difficult to get any kind of useful distance about these people. When you're writing about something that's still going on, for example, a thesis on Saul Bellow right now is, from my point of view, quite useless, since Bellow is still doing extraordinary work, is still going from genre to genre. He just published, for example, he published a very bad novel, The Dean's December. Now he's published a wonderful book of short stories. So if someone 3 or 4 years ago had been writing about that, you know. And then, frankly, a lot of the stuff on Bellow owes its vitality to all sorts of Jewish scholars who are interested in his Jewishness, which is enormous, and are sort of cultivating the ethnic side of all this, which, again, you know, is extra literary. It's not for much use, you know. And most of all, if you write about contemporary literature, it takes you away from the great writers. The past.
I certainly would agree with you about Beattie, but what about Robert Lowell? You mentioned Lowell. I noticed that the whole cottage industry is sprung up around Lowell. There are more books. There are more books of criticism about Lowell than Lowell turned out poems.
Well, no, that's not so, but. Well, you see, I don't know if you ever saw a piece I wrote for the Times Literary Supplement in London. I reviewed, did a long essay on Lowell when this biography of him came out. And I said that part of the problem was, you see, that, you know, Lowell was such an unstable character. He was a manic depressive. He was a wonderful poet, one of my favorite poets. But he was also, you know, he was, as these things go, an American aristocrat, and one of the most famous families in America. But he was also an extremely troubled, unstable person. And one of the things that I cannot stand about contemporary literature, I mean, is the amount of gossip and the rest of it. I mean, everybody knew the way Lowell died. You know, he came back. He was married to a third writer, came back on his way to, he hoped to remarry his second wife. And, you know, you probably know that when the taxi pulled up at Elizabeth Hardwick's house, his old house, he was dead. He had died coming in from Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that, you see. And the other thing, to speak very frankly, is the enormous self-glorification either of ethnic groups or lately, of course, of women writers, where the whole thing's become such a mass movement. I don't think women writers are interesting because they're women. An awful lot of books are being published now. Thousands of books have been published since the feminist movement began, dealing with the problems of being a woman writer. And the thing is being overdone in a very sentimental, rather harsh way, you know. And you're going to get thousands of letters.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't quite know what you mean when you said that.
We live in a culture in which every day it is suggested that the next candidate, Democratic Party, should have nominated as a vice president a woman, any woman. In other words, not a particular woman, which would make sense, but any woman. Because we live in a culture of constituencies, you know, Jews, blacks, women, gays, all the rest of it. And what I'm saying, I think, is not difficult at all. I don't know. I think you're probably more shocked than anything else by what I'm saying. I'm saying that these many books now which have come out seem to me to emphasize the woman's angle rather than the literary angle. And there are very gifted writers like Adrienne Rich, the poet, who's a radical feminist and who really believes that women can do it, can go it alone, so to speak, entirely, you know, with the result that there is, for my money, an extremely unpleasant air of resentment of men, attacks upon men. And I gave up on this kind of thing when I read a poem by Adrian Rich called Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is a Sexual Message, in which one of the greatest, most beautiful works of art produced by our culture was savagely attacked because, according to Miss Rich, Beethoven was impotent, and that's why you get all that with sounds. And
well, we've been slowly but surely backing into an American procession.
Yes, I think we should.
And moving from some of the personal elements in your life to some of the what you've written in American Procession. 1830 to 1930, why is that the crucial century in American literature?
I call it the crucial century because American literature, as we know it, modern literature, begins with Emerson. And Emerson left the church in 1832. He was a Unitarian minister. And I show in my book that Emerson's decision to leave the church and to become a lecturer and a writer established a writing on a professional basis, which he was able to do, but most of all, that he was overwhelmed by the importance of individual freedom, of the idea of the individual as a kind of precious unit. He felt that American independence, American culture, were both based entirely on the self-reliance, to quote his title of his famous essay. And this tradition of individualism, which he founded as a thing in literature, lasted until the end of the 1920s, with especially with writers like Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and Dos Passos, and Eliot and Pound, who spiritually and psychologically belonged to the same tradition of what one might call American individualism. And I ended deliberately on the eve of the Great Depression, because I think with the Depression and the 1930s, they came in a very different kind of culture, based more upon mass groups, based more upon mass suffering. And the other thing, of course, is that slowly, by the 40s and 50s, especially after the Second World War, technology and the extraordinary transformation of our world by technology made literature seem less central, less important than it had been. From Emerson to Hemingway, one thing can be said as a matter of course. To them, literature was the most important thing in the world, and being a writer was the most important thing in the world. Today we have many, many gifted writers, wonderful writers. But no one can claim that the literature today has the same importance that people once did. Our presidents don't write their own speeches. They don't make literary references. Our leaders of industry and such are not interested in literature. For obvious reasons, the visual arts and the mass media have taken over. Television is today, in many ways, in the 20th century, what the 19th century novel used to be. It tells stories. It's absolutely hypnotic and fascinating. People can't go away from it. And it exercises the kind of changes in people's minds and lives which writers like Dickens and Tolstoy used to.
What period in American history would you have liked to have lived?
The period in which I'm living now, because because I don't think I would have been allowed to live in any other period, so to speak. That is, the people from whom I derive came to America in mass groups just exactly a century ago from Eastern Europe because of persecution. And earlier than that, it was very difficult for people of my background to come over. They wouldn't have had any reason to come over. They wouldn't have been able to come over. And also, this is a fascinating period in which I feel that everything is, so to speak, on edge. There's a tremendous sense of challenge in the atmosphere every day.
Well, of course, I meant what literary period, I think, more than anything else. Obviously, you mentioned a moment ago that there are so many distractions that that literature is no longer central in our lives, but would you rather live in an era where literature was, say, the turn of the century?
I have the best of two worlds. I read the books I love from other periods, and I live in this period.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, if I had lived, let's say, 19th century, I would not have been able to read 19th century novels. I can now, ironically enough.
Some of those 19th century novels, nobody can fault you, obviously, on your selections. I mean, Hawthorne and Thoreau and Whitman and Melville and so forth. But there were an awful lot of novels written in the 19th century that have just vanished from our sight. And some of them I have looked over because I would browse through bookstores and bring home these old books that just seemed shallow, and the triteness of Victorian writing sometimes can be jarring. So you have had to make a very specific selection of the writers that that you feel were preeminent.
There are even major writers I left out, but I can't write about writers I don't love and who don't interest me enormously. This is, in one sense, a very personal book, as all my books are. I was writing about my connection with the books I love and the writers I love. I didn't want to pretend that it was my job to rehabilitate certain reputations. And, for example, I'm very fond of Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I've written about it. But she is not, to my mind, the kind of totally vibratory writer that, let's say, Hawthorne is. And my particular hero, I suppose, in the spirit, is Herman Melville, who I think had the greatest mind in American literature. That includes the present. The chapters in which I'm most pleased, which the book, because the book was written over a very long time, so I explained, about 20 years, are writers like Melville who are constantly transforming themselves, constantly thinking up new thoughts, and at the same time represent the fantastic American experience, because American experience. After all, Melville really knew the outside world as no other writer of his period did, you know. He was a sailor, a roustabout, a drifter for over 4.5 years. And he came back, he really knew what things were about.
Well, Alfred Kazin, kind of wrap things up a little bit, because I know that you have a theater date tonight. It's certainly been a pleasure that I've been able to get a glimpse of you and your thinking. Do you deliver to your students much the same message that you have made in An American Procession?
No. I don't do anything deliberately with my students except to nag them to get on with their reading and thinking. I want them to develop their own thinking and reading. I suppose inevitably what I think about certain writers comes out, you see. And a lot of this stuff, of course, was used, as I explained in the foreword to my book, in seminars here and abroad. I've taught in a great many places here and abroad. And over the years, I sort of kept on polishing my insights, you know. One of my friends compares my method to a sculptor constantly brushing here and adding a little thing there, you know. But the figure's already there to begin with, so to speak. With my students, my great aim is to induce a love of literature and a patience in research. And also, most of my students are PhD candidates, and there are very few jobs these days. One of the many instances of what I call the diminished feeling for the authority of literature is the fact that there are so few jobs available in the humanities.
You've been teaching for many years. Have you noticed any change in the nature of the young people that you're teaching? Are they any less interested in literature and writing than they were, say, when you first started teaching 20, 25, 30 years ago or longer?
Well, I started teaching in the evening. A lot of my students were dopey left-wingers who wouldn't read H.G. Wells and people like that because they objected to him politically. On the other hand, there was more... There was a greater respect for the literary act per se years ago. The problem now, you see, first of all, it depends where you're teaching. A place like Harvard and Yale, these very keen students really educate each other. At places, the faculty has less and less faith in itself and less confidence that what it's imparting is important, you know. And the real problem I have with my students is their morale. They often feel that, why am I doing this? Why am I spending all these years taking a PhD when there are no jobs? Things like that. But it all depends. In New York, it's the life with the teach, because a lot of my students are old-fashioned New York intellectuals with a passion for ideas and Westford. This is not true, for example, in the Midwest where I've taught to, and that sort of thing.
You're teaching at the Graduate Center, CC.
Yes, yes.
That's on the 42nd Street?
That's right. Uh-huh. Right across the public library.
Do you teach at CCNY uptown at all?
No. I used to teach at Hunter College as well, but I'm being transferred entirely to... I just have one more year to teach. I have to retire in June 85.
When you have to retire?
I'll be 70 years old next year.
It's mandatory retirement? No kidding.